Hey everybody, welcome to the 31st episode of the JDO Show. I am your host, J. David Osborne, and today on the program I have Violet Lavoie, author of I Miss the World, which, if you are friends with me on Facebook, you've heard me talk about pretty consistently because I fucking loved it. It's probably the best book that I read this year. Before you listen to this, you must know one thing, very important. We discuss the end of the book, which is pretty fucked up, right? Why the fuck would I do that? But we talk, there's so much going on at the end. There's so much, she does so much fucked up shit at the end. I had to talk about it because it kicked my ass so hard. So there'll be a point in the recording, and it's kind of hard for me to tell where it is now as I'm recording this, because depending on how long this intro is, it affects where it is in the podcast itself. But I definitely say, hey, spoiler alert. And then if you skip about 10 minutes ahead, we start to talk about movies. So in the show notes, I'll have a more direct idea of where exactly the spoilers are, and I'll indicate them for you so that you don't get it spoiled. But really, I mean, you really should probably just go ahead and get this book. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. I now have a Facebook page, so go look us up at the JDO Show on Facebook. Smash that motherfucking like button. Thank you very much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode with Violet Lavoie. Hey, Violet, thanks for being on the podcast.
It is a super pleasure. How are you?
I am doing really, really well. So you got a new microphone?
It is a fantastic microphone, and the nerd at Best Buy who advised me on it said that this was the only one he ever uses for his YouTube video game videos. So I was like, great, I'll do it.
Is it a Blue Yeti?
It is. It's the what is it? The blue, and it's a snowball.
He sold
me on this. This is metal. You want something with the metal pieces rather than the plastic. So
that's exactly the kind that I got. So
yeah,
we're using the same mic here. So that's a weird thing that I only became hip to recently, is that there are people out there who make fucking good money just playing video games on the internet.
Oh my God, I don't even want to talk about it. So my day job, I work for a company that does data about entertainment, and we get the Variety and Hollywood Reporter, you know, the daily updates. PewDiePie made $15 million last year.
Now, just, this is a gamer?
A gamer dude. Some dude out of, I don't know, what is he, Swedish or something? He plays video games and he talks over them and makes jokes. And he made $15 million last year. And I just saw that. I'm like, we're in the wrong business.
Yeah, no shit. I was watching Jeremy Johnson's kid. And one of his favorite things to do is to watch YouTube videos of video games. And
yeah,
one of them was literally a game where you make sandwiches for these monsters, and then the monsters either like the sandwich or they don't, and the guy's talking, he's like, all right, well, I got some ketchup and some mustard here, and wait, I'm not done with the sandwich yet. Oh, look, he likes it. Oh my God. And this motherfucker is probably just, I looked him up too, and there's like a I forget what site I looked it up on, one of those creepy, like, find people's net worth things. And right, sure enough, yeah, he's not making, like, PewDiePie money, but he's making about 45, 50 grand a year doing that.
And you know what's funny is, like, so my older son is 9. When he plays video games just of his own pleasure, he chatters along to himself like he's one of those guys narrating, okay, we got to get the sword. This is definitely the sword we want. Whoa, we dropped it now. Now we go, got to get some wool to pay for a more sword. We finally just told them, like, you know, you could just play them. There's nobody listening to you right now. Just chill. Just do it your way.
Yeah, no kidding. So have you ever gotten into video games at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I'm a child of the 80s, so everything I loved was 8-bit stuff.
Yeah.
And then it was like as soon as the Nintendo, what was the original one? The one that came out in 86 with like the little rectangular, there's the cross and the two buttons.
Mm-mm-mm.
You know the one I mean? What is that? That's the...
I don't... The first... The first one I had was a... I wasn't allowed to have video games until I was like 10, so I had a...
Okay.
I had like the original PlayStation was my first
one. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So when that, I had an Atari 2600, and that's like my rosebud. That was just the greatest thing ever. And then the Nintendo thing came along and I was like, no joystick, you're dead to me, video games. And I just was not interested for years until when I went to college, I got, I started out in art school at School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and focused on video art and computer, sort of like at the beginning of when Photoshop was really taking off. And so I had an interest in computer graphics, and that was about the time that arcade games started being sophisticated enough that they could render 3D shapes in real time, like the first edition of Virtua Fighter and everything. And my mind was just blown by this. This was completely fascinating. But I was more interested in it from a like a visual point of view rather than a gameplay kind of thing. And this is something I get in, not discussions, but, you know, with my husband, because he's 15 years younger than me, and his idea of a video game is like a rich, immersive environment that you want the most realistic graphics and a goal, a quest, something that you, a story that you have to work through. For me, I have enough goals and quests in my everyday life. I don't need another pretend one. You know what I mean?
Oh, totally.
And yeah, and the other side is like, what I really loved about the 2600 games was how spare and minimalist they were, and what a maximum amount of investment you needed to put yourself in them, to be 8 years old and say, you know, I am that square going through this dungeon, having adventure. And there's something, when it's spelled out for you, when you just become an avatar, like, you know, I am Link, that's different than I am a square. Did you ever read the book, what is it, Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's like how he talks in there about how the most iconic comic characters are things like Charlie Brown, which is just basically, you know, a little variation on a smiley face.
Right.
Or, you know, Tintin, who doesn't really have that defined facial features. And it's because we can, when out in the world, we can see other people's faces clearly for who they are. We keep a map of like, all right, this is what my mother looks like. This is what my best friend looks like. But when you think about yourself, you don't think about your own facial features specifically. You just have sort of a hazy vision of who you are. So his argument is that the vaguer and blander and more just iconic smiley facey character is, the more we can project ourselves into them, because it's more like our own vague gauzy image of ourselves. And so that's why I love the 8-bit games, because of that lack of specificity. But, you know, as games become more sophisticated, I'm not saying they're not beautiful. My son went over, a friend of ours babysat him last night, and they played Final Fantasy 15. The game is gorgeous. What can I say? You know, but I can't imagine it holding my attention for longer than an afternoon.
That's my problem too, is that I think I do some real quick math in my head where I think, okay, I'm level one.
And, right.
All right. I just got this amount of XP. All right. Now I'm level two. Shit, that took like 30 minutes.
Right.
Right. I have to be level 150 to like beat this game. Like, fuck that. And so one really interesting thing that I like about what you're saying about the, you know, the avatars and the kind of featurelessness is that it seems like it might be scooping back around towards that with things like Minecraft and is even more so in like virtual reality, where you are represented. At this point, I don't believe there is any full body VR yet. I think you're just a pair of hands. So I was listening to a podcast about this the other day, and what's so interesting is that there's almost a spiritual component to this, where you put on the VR goggles and you look around and you are no longer your body, right? You're just this pair of hands. So like what actually are you if you're not your body, if there's like no avatar whatsoever? So that's kind of, I mean, I don't know. I haven't tried them. Have you tried the virtual reality stuff yet?
No, not like the new generation, like the Oculus Rift and stuff like that. No, that is an interesting idea. I wonder what happens when you float disembodied in a space like that. It's not unlike the experiments they do with phantom limbs, where they sit you, if a scientist sits you in front of a mirror, and you put, you know, one hand on one side and the other hand, they sort of, you'd say, leave your hand under the table, but they sort of drape a sleeve connected to a rubber hand, which they'll put on the table. And they'll stroke a brush simultaneously on both your, you know, let's say your left hand and the rubber hand that's you're pretending is your right hand.
Mm-hmm.
If they do that for about 30 seconds to sort of establish some kind of link with your brain, and then if they come out of nowhere and hit that rubber hand with a hammer, your brain will react. You will have a pain sensation it's really crazy. I mean, there's videos of it, of people undergoing this hack of your brain and how it you can trick your brain into extending what you understand as your consciousness or the boundaries of your body into inanimate objects. And so with a VR in which you're disembodied, the opposite is happening. And I would be really curious to see how people's sense of self changes in an environment like that.
Yeah, and I wonder if it couldn't, you know, sort of like the opportunities for it to be used as an empathy tool, which I think most like good art actually is, I think are and I think it's the thing about it being an empathy tool is what most modern games are lacking, and what
totally.
I was never able to connect with them, because
it
does it becomes I mean, it started with the 8-bit stuff and having a quest and having to build up sort of a purse of items and you know, experience and things like that. And then they just sort of started stacking that on top of each other, and story became loosely kind of hung on this same kind of goal-oriented game system, basically.
Acquisitional,
Yeah, but I mean, like, there are games that I have not played, but that, you know, there's the game who that programmer who took a lot of shit from the Gamergate people. She did the game about like what it's like to have depression, and I'm just kind of interested as to, you know, I wonder why those like haven't really caught on at all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about that too. But what were you going to say?
Oh no! That I was just trailing off.
Yeah. I mean, have there ever been any games that stimulated empathy?
Oh, that's a really good question.
You want to say like the Tamagotchi? Is that like the where you're taking care of a living being, or The Sims? Does that do it? Or
oh wow, yeah. I mean, I guess it could, but I almost think that those would work in the opposite, because there's no real consequence for the death of any of these characters.
Right.
You know, I mean, like you kind of you can how empathetic you feel depends on how far your imagination was willing to extend in the first place.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't know. But I mean, I guess in a lot of ways, that's something that I feel like film and books have been able to do in a way that video games haven't quite gotten to yet.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which actually, so I guess like kind of the first, if you want like an I Miss the World question.
Mm-hmm.
So you live in...
And I just have to say, so when we talk about this, how spoilery or not spoilery would you like me to get?
Okay, well, that's entirely up to you. I think I have kind of a weird relationship to spoilers in that they've never kept me from watching or reading. And in fact, sometimes, for me at least, knowing the end of something or where it goes will actually make me more interested to watch or read it.
Interesting. Okay.
But, I mean, it's totally up to you. I mean, I can even do like a spoiler warning, tell people, like put something in and say, hey, skip, you know, to 5 minutes ahead if you don't want to know or whatever.
Okay. All right. I mean, I leave it up to, I would love people to read it without it being spoiled, but at the same time, this is an opportunity, the first opportunity I've had really to talk about some of the deeper themes and to allow you a place to have some deeper questions about it. So I'm happy to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Cool. Okay. So my first is kind of like, I guess it's more of a surface level thing, which is you live in Philly, right?
I do. Yeah.
Now, did you spend time in Los Angeles?
Yes. Okay. So the story with that is about 3 years ago. To really start, to back up a little bit, I'm originally from Baltimore. And I came to Philadelphia in 2009 because I was following a former husband to a job. And once we got to Philly, our marriage broke up. And I stayed here for the sake of my older son so that I could be closer by. But I'd left a lot behind in Baltimore. I'd sacrificed a lot to come up here. I was a TV producer in Baltimore. I worked for the Maryland Public Television PBS affiliate. I was a radio personality. I did movie reviews on the radio. I was a film critic for the Baltimore City Paper. Baltimore is a small enough arts community that I was sort of a minor celebrity in that scene. And, you know, I was invited to speak in front of, you know, special events or things like that. And that all disappeared when I went out to Philly, and I was nobody. And I was poor. I was a single parent all of a sudden, and I was in grad school, and I was struggling to keep my way through that. And this is all during, you know, the worst recession we've ever seen. And I could live 6 months and then I'd get thrown out of there. They were just really nasty, raw years. So about 3 years ago, during the thick of all of this, I'm writing. I'm finishing my grad degree. I think it was either done by then or it was on hiatus because I had to take a leave of absence from school because I was a whistleblower because of faculty misconduct. But that's a whole nother story. So, you know, nothing about these past 5-6 years had been easy. So while I'm working at this food co-op, which it was just a sort of a handful of, I don't remember what the perfect storm was, but it was like 4 or 5 responsibilities came down hard, very hard on me all of a sudden. And I just cracked. I came into work one day and I was already stressed out about everything I had to do. And then I got a notice from my son's father saying, oh, by the way, you've got to pick him up at school these days, because there's no school. And you know how like gymnasts, they say, well, when I landed funny, I knew I felt something pop in my knee. Like, you know how they say that sometimes they know something. That's exactly what happened in the moment. I felt something pop in my brain, like something just went. And the whole reality around me got very slow. Like everything had been kind of turned down about 30%. And somebody was telling me something, and the words coming in the mouth were extra slow. And they looked at me and they said, are you all right? And I said, I think I have to go upstairs.
Sounds like you were experiencing a ton of like consistent adrenaline or something.
Yes, right? That's probably what happened, that I had some kind of adrenalinic reaction. So somebody else, the manager, came up to me and says, you look like hell, hang up your apron, please go home. So I said, okay, all I needed to do was walk up the stairs to the break room, pick up my bag and walk down the stairs and go out. I had to crawl up the stairs and I was standing there staring at my bag for the life of me. I could not figure out how to pick up my bag. And I just crumpled down into this little crying, shrieking mess. And somebody came out and they said, what is wrong? And I said, take me to the hospital. So they drove me over to Penn Medical Center, which actually has a great psych ward. And, you know, I'm just sort of screaming into my hands the whole day, way that we're there. And here's a pro tip. If you want to go to the front of the triage line, come into the ER screaming. So that's what happened. And they saw me right away. And this poor, terrified nurse is looking at me saying, hey, what brings you here today? And it, like, all I could say was, life sucks. And then they said, do you want to be seen by the psych staff here? And that question was just so unbelievably stupid that I just started screaming into the linoleum.
Right.
And while I'm screaming and I cannot stop shrieking, at the same time this is happening, there's a tiny little voice in my head saying, you know, people really don't shriek like this. Like, like really, this is not how people act. Why don't you stop acting like this? But I just could not. So they took me into psych and, you know, I still had to wait all day. I just sort of laid crumpled over a sofa in the waiting room and just waited for people coming in, coming out. And what else can you do? So finally at about 5 o'clock, you know, and I'd been there for about 6 hours, they got me a bed. And all I can think now is, this was really dumb because I had already been making plans. This was one of the things that had stressed me out. I had already been making plans to do my first tour of LA. So I was going to hit like a couple dates in LA and then head up to BizarroCon afterwards. And I was like, they're going to keep me here overnight. I'm leaving in 3 days. This was so dumb. Why did I say take me to the psych ward? So I'm sitting in this, you know, and the walls really are padded in the psych ward. They, you know, that's not just a fiction. They really are. I was looking around saying, yep, here they are. So two doctors came in. One was an older guy and one was a younger guy. They both have the white jackets on, you know, and they come in, how are you feeling today? And I'm like, well, I feel like crap. And they're asking me, you know, do you have a history of that? I said, well, I do. I have bipolar disorder and I've had a couple of pretty serious manic episodes in my life. And they said, do you have any how are you feeling now? Are you sleeping? Do you have any grandiose thoughts? And I said, well, I'm planning a tour of LA for a book that no one has ever heard of and will probably never hear of. And I'm self-financing this tour up and down the West Coast so that people can hear about it. And they said, well, you know, do you think you're going to win, you know, Pulitzer? And I said, no, that's delusional. And they laughed.
Right.
And then the older guy turned to the other guy and said, well, okay, you'll see a sense of humor is a sign of this or this and that. And they said, okay, we're going to give you a Valium and we're going to send you home. And that was it. That stupid little off the cuff joke won me my freedom. You know,
that's so interesting that, so I guess what they're saying is that when people become a danger, I guess they've completely lost their sense of humor. Is that?
Yeah. That a sense of humor was a sign of some kind of higher brain function or, you know, being sort of with it or could see the irony of the situation, whatever. So, you know, I think it gave me a Xanax, which I enjoyed very much. And then sent me home, and you know, my mother, God bless her, she came up for a couple of days just while I just got myself back together, and then I got on a plane to go to LA. And when I got to LA, I was just like, my God, this is, I've wanted to be here my whole life. And I couldn't tell whether it was because I was so familiar with it as from a lifetime of watching movies as a film critic, because it looks very much like a movie when you're in it, because of all movies that have been shot there. So you've been there too,
right? Right. Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. I've been there several times. Rios has a family down there. So we.
Oh, she does. Okay.
Yeah. We tend to visit quite often. And we most recently went over the summer. So.
Okay. Okay. I love it there. I absolutely love it. And I was so glad I went there. And I hooked up with a friend of mine, Mira Ippolito, who was she's a screenwriter. And we went to the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, which is, I love going to cemeteries when I go to studios, and just being there then. Like, yeah, and that's sort of where the beginning of the, so when I got back, I wrote an essay for Press Play about Paul Walker dying and sort of the irony of this guy who was in the Fast and the Furious movies dying in this fiery car crash. Mm-hmm. And I think I had sent that to you when we were talking about doing something for Broken River or something. And you know, I sent you that as a sample and you were like, great, that sounds good. So the idea for I Miss the World had sort of been percolating since then. And then I don't know exactly how, like, you know, what you negotiated with Mike about between Broken River and King Shot or whatever, but it ended up being a King Shot book. So so that was its long 3-year genesis.
Okay, and how long did the actual writing itself take? Was it
Well, I knew that I had to finish it quickly because I was pregnant. And I did not want to be finishing a novel while I had a newborn, because I knew that was just going to, it just wasn't going to be possible. You can't even feed or shower yourself during that time. So this was the quickest novel I've ever written. I think it probably took a year and a half total. And it started out in a couple different iterations. Like I was originally, it was sort of the shreds of, I did a National Novel Writing Month where every year I say I'm going to do it. And then I only get a handful of words in. But I did, just as an experiment this year, I wrote a series of vignettes based on tarot cards, all taking place in LA from different time periods, just different than the way I usually work, where I usually start with a plan or a concept. This was just sort of an intuitive start from a sentence and go from there. So there was a handful of stuff in that, and I thought maybe I would continue that tarot idea, but then the most compelling story out of this was a conversation between a brother and a sister in Hollywood Forever Cemetery, which is, you know, one of my favorite places. So, and as that grew, then, you know, because I was also thinking about, well, maybe I like the idea of a book that never ends or a book that is in sort of an infinite loop. And so I started, you know, I hashed out with Mike a little bit about, well, could we have a book where the top of the page is printed right side up and the bottom of page is right side down, so that when you get to the last page, you've got to turn the book around and you go back. So it's just sort of this endless loop. So, you know, while he was mulling over, could they actually do that? I started thinking, I was like, you know, I am interested in some of the qualities of how things look on the page. Like some of the stories in I Am Genghis Khan or I'll Fuck Anything That Moves and Stephen Hawking are about the visual presence of text on the page. But I decided printing each page right side up and upside down and having the reader flip the book it was just a little too gimmicky. I didn't really feel like it was serving the narrative. It was going the other way around. So rather than do that, in the writing, I found a way to make it an infinite loop.
Is that where you draw the line then, like between gimmick and kind of sort of like an artful construction of a story? Like, is there a certain point where, how do you gauge when it overwhelms the story itself or not?
I think it's like, you know, sometimes you see a woman wearing a dress and sometimes that dress is wearing her. You know what I mean? When the gimmick is wearing the story, then that's too much. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel ultimately that the story was going to be served with that kind of typographic trickery. But there was something about the story that needed to be, or rather there was a way that I could put in that endless loop quality of it without having to express it typographically, which is not to say I'm against doing something typographic. You know, I may do something like that in the future, but it just wasn't right for this story.
And with stories in general, where is that? Is that where like the, I am literally asking the most basic, stupid interview question, like, where do ideas come from?
Right.
But you had mentioned earlier kind of about sort of the genesis of that. So I'm fascinated by the way that your brain works. So I'm going to ask that stupid question.
Sure. So the one genesis was, of course, the nervous breakdown and that trip to LA. And oh, I forgot. So the day after I got back from LA and BizarroCon and everything, in the news, a woman had a allergic reaction to anesthetic on after having some cosmetic surgery and stood naked on a roof and fell down. So that's actually real. And I thank the woman at the end of the book. Her name was Sandra de Arial. And from what I understand, she was a very nice woman and she was just having a cosmetic procedure and she just had like a anesthetic delirium, which is a thing. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I put her, you know, that's what I was thinking. I was like, wow, I had sort of this pang of, you know, my condolences to her family and everything. But now that I was back in Philly, I had this pang of, see, I should be where the action is. I should be where these things are happening. So, but anyway, the main thing about the structure of the book, a friend of mine, Josh O'Neill, who runs this amazing graphic novel press called Beehive Books in Philadelphia, he lent me a copy of Nicholson Baker's book, The Mezzanine. Have you ever read that?
I have not yet tackled that one. It's a big one.
Yeah. Well, no, The Mezzanine is little and skinny.
Oh,
that's a teeny tiny one.
Which one am I thinking of then?
I don't remember which one's huge. I don't know if like Fermata is huge or... So I know that Vox and Mezzanine are really skinny little books.
Oh, okay. Right on. Okay. Cool, cool.
So The Mezzanine, the plot of that one is... A man steps on the bottom of an escalator and rides it all the way to the top. That's all the action that takes place in the book.
Right.
But the bulk of the book is his internal monologue as he's on the escalator about why is he on the escalator? He's got to go buy a shoelace. The shoelace broke at work. What happened at work? How the shoelace reminds him of all these other things. Why is an ice cube tray the way they made it this way? Why is it better to cut a sandwich, you know, on the diagonal rather than the horizontal? Well, of course it's better because then if it's on the diagonal, you can fit the corner in your mouth very easily. If it's on the horizontal, you have to kind of smear up your cheeks while you're eating. I was like, my God, he's absolutely right. So he goes on and on with all these little minutiae observations about life in the 20th century but I loved the audacity of that's what happens in the novel. A guy rides an escalator from the top to the bottom.
Yeah.
So there was that thought about it. And then there's also the Nicholson Baker book Vox, which is a transcript conversation of two people having phone sex. But because it's a Nicholson Baker book, they have a little bit of phone sex and then they talk about how you slice sandwiches and why ice cube trays are different. And, you know, so
right.
All of that stuff. So those two things were the major influence in how I was writing that. And the thing about Vox is it has a very eavesdroppery feel to it. And I was talking about this, was I talking about this with you earlier, but that a book, you know, you get like a 400-page book. Yeah, that's right, because your blog post was saying that a 400-page book is a lot. It's a lot to like ask someone to plow through. And what I think is that it's a lot to ask a reader to push 400 words through. I think if you're going to write 400 words, you have to give them the tow rope 20 pages in that mm-hmm. they can just hook their car to and you tow them through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's your job as the writer to pull them through. So That's
and one thing
what I
that's
was.
sort of like interesting about what you're saying there and what I totally agree with is this concept of fucking responsibility, like as a writer, and not a responsibility to, you know, not agitate and not disturb and not, you know, ruffle feathers, but a responsibility to not waste time to the best of your ability.
Yeah, absolutely. Because time is life.
Right.
You know, you're asking people to give you a little bit of your life, their lives for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing I was thinking about. You know, I Miss the World is an intensely personal book, and I'm never going to write a book this personal again because I had no idea what it would be like to see it, you know, just sort of nakedly available for in book form. In manuscript form, it's such a leap to book form. You're like, oh my God, I really did not want my secrets out there like that. But anyway, we can talk about that in a little bit. But having written something so personal, and my previous books being so personal in their own way, I realize that people do, you know, you get encouraged, write about your feelings, write about them. It's good for you. It's healing. But you know what? People do not want to hear your story. They want to hear their story told by a professional.
There we go. Yep.
Yeah. And that's why the novels that are universal, not, you know, not applying to everyone, but say something specific about the human experience. That's why those novels last and those characters last and why people love them. Mm-hmm. And that's the responsibility that once you've earned your chops and you can write about yourself and that's fine because you're learning and growing. But after a certain point, it shouldn't be about you. It shouldn't be about, you know, using your talents for your own glory. It should be about other people and, you know, adding something to the human canon of understanding. So, but anyway, I forgot how we got onto that.
I don't remember either, but I,
yeah.
I totally agree. And I will just kind of tack on sort of the idea that there's also the element of people want to see themselves reflected back. And that's true. But there's also, I think that when you read a book more so than when you watch a movie, you kind of engage in this symbiotic relationship with it because it requires work in order to ingest it.
Right.
And so in a certain sense, you sort of become the book itself. And when you hate a book, the reason why people hate books so intensely is because they begin to hate themselves because, it's this kind of thing. So I think another thing, though, is that one thing that people like the most more than anything is novelty and seeing things in a different way because there's nothing quite like the way that, like, when you find out how something works, when you open up a TV and you see all the wires. And and so I think that's what somebody like Nicholson Baker or, you know, you do well. Also, I think Cody Goodfellow is really good at this too, just being able to see how things work in a different way. And because you have that symbiotic relationship, it's like, oh, now I see it that way. Oh, this is cool.
Right.
And it's a little, it's a little dopamine totally. Hits along the way.
Totally. Totally. I mean, the other great one for that was, who was it? David Foster Wallace, who he had a handful of, I love, what is a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again. I love his nonfiction essays more than his fiction. But he had just a perfect little, they weren't fancy metaphors, but they just completely distilled a person. Like there was one where he talked about the John McCain campaign, and he described the union cameramen waiting around sitting on their duffel bags as like lizards sunning themselves on a rock. And the other one is favorite. He goes to the AVN, the Adult Video Awards. He describes one man as he is wearing a leopard print suit and he greets people by pointing at them. It's like, that's everything you need to know about that guy.
I fucking know that guy.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
So as I write more, that becomes my goal, to get less fancy and more precise. And I've been looking at people like Michael Chabon and, you know, Nicholson Baker and who else is really good at that? Jonathan Safran Foer is, his book, is he wrote Eating Animals, right? I'm not mixing him up with another guy. I think that's who
he's also the one who had that fucking embarrassing email exchange with Natalie Portman.
Oh my God. Yeah. I completely ignored that. You know, it's funny when I was in LA, this is when I had this revelation. I was reading a Hollywood Reporter in LA and they had photos of Natalie Portman's house. And it's this huge, exorbitant, you know, one percenter's house. And I just sort of had a revelation of like, she doesn't, you know, I've never met Natalie Portman, and apparently she's, you know, involved in all kinds of progressive social action, and, you know, and good for her, but she doesn't represent me. I'm never going to have that house, and she has no desire in helping me get that house unless I write a project that she wants to star in or something like that. And just, I don't know, just some, maybe something about being in LA and seeing that created the synergy of realizing, you just kind of piercing the veil of celebrity of like, these people are not my avatars. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and it gets to a really weird, when you start to pierce that reality bubble, it gets very fucking weird very quickly. I mean, I even experienced it to a certain extent when I was an extra. I was an extra in this film called Green Room.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're there, like, at the craft service table waiting for your time to go on, you're kind of surrounded by these lifer extras, right?
Yeah.
Who have made a career out of being an extra, which, you know, fantastic. I mean, it's good money.
Right.
You can make
$150
to $200 a day just for like an hour's work, you know? And so, but like whenever I would talk to these guys, you know, they were supposed to be playing teenage skinheads, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the one guy there is definitely like in his late 50s, but he's dressed up like a punk, right? Like he's got his costume on and he's got spiked hair,
like a class of 84 kind of punk.
Precisely. And he's talking about the next gigs that he's gonna get, but he's using this this fucking manner and just way of speaking and the different jargons and stuff like that, where I'm like, and LA is that writ large, right? So
yeah,
you end up going there and you're like, those people, LA people, are not, they're unlike any other people in the entire world.
Right, totally.
Like they exist in a world, they exist in movie world. Everybody does. One time Cody took me for a ride out by his house, and we were driving through this neighborhood, and he said, do you notice anything weird about these houses? And I was like, none of the lights are on. And he's like, that's because they only have one side of the house, right? And it's a street where they go to shoot film.
Wow.
And so if you were to look behind him, there's no house, but it looks like a neighborhood.
Wow.
That's LA.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen this documentary? It's called LA Plays Itself, or Los Angeles Plays Itself. It's this guy who's a local talking about locations in Los Angeles that are in movies, but he's got this very dry Leonard Cohen-y kind of narration, like seen it all. He's not impressed or starstruck or anything about it. But, you know, one of the locations that he goes to is a full McDonald's building, a full franchise building that is kept empty year round so they can shoot commercials in it.
Wow.
And it's just on a street corner somewhere in, I don't know, but it's cheaper to do that than it is to pick a franchise and have everybody clear out and, you know, pay the guy who owns it for a week to make up lost profits and everything. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just wonder what it's like to, like, psychically to exist in a place in like the ground zero for a signal that goes around the world, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I loved about it, because it was like the line between fiction and nonfiction were very, very thin there. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, I loved that. And I started thinking, you know, the name California, the state is named after this fictional land that was in a novel. That's how it got named. Yeah, because I was looking into, like, where do state names come from? Like, how many of them are Native American names? How many of them are French? I mean, California was in a novel from the 1800s. Somebody just thought, that sounds great. You know, this is a paradise. We'll name it that.
So it would be like finding a new state and naming it fucking Hogwarts.
Exactly, yeah. Or Narnia, you know?
Or Narnia, like, yeah.
And then Tarzana, California, is because Edgar Rice Burroughs was out there. So Tarzana, California is like the most fictional place in the United States, the most novel-y place.
No shit.
So, yeah.
So, But
that's what I love about the place, so.
Oh, yeah, no, super fan. Like, so I guess going back to this, okay, so there's this this conversation that they have, and we have a set designer. And
yes.
We have a person who is in charge of picking a casting person.
Casting director.
Thank you, Jesus.
Yeah.
but so there's a lot of and I think most of the discussion around this book is probably going to be centered around its kind of philosophical ideas. Because there's a lot of them. But the thing that I found the most fascinating was the relationship between the past, the present, and the future through consumer products.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could kind of explain in better detail what I'm getting at there.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what it is this sense of loss that I had, because not only during these dark years did I get divorced, but also my grandmother, who was a beloved grandmother, she got Alzheimer's and she started fading away. And it took probably about, she had excellent care. So she lasted a lot longer than a lot of people do. But after about 6 years, she died. And I don't think I acknowledged at the time, you prepare yourself for it. It's a very long goodbye. And, but when it happens, it blindsided me. And I had my nervous breakdown maybe about 3 months after it happened. So it was just a cumulative thing. So it's that idea of, a lot of that is in the book, this feeling of loss and of the objects of loss and trying to understand where did these things go, and a little bit of survivor's guilt of like, why am I still here and all the Atari 2600s are dead,
Right.
And so
that's very interesting. And I guess the feeling that I got when I read it is one that I think I got probably the strongest when I went to Graceland, actually. And have you ever been?
No, I never have.
Okay, so when you go in, there's all this shit that was super high tech and rad for the 1970s or so. But you're walking down hallways and it's all glass panels and these fucking shag carpet that was so shag that your feet literally disappear into it. And Elvis had this jungle room with this ultra tacky, like indoor kind of bubbling pond and trees and shit. Right. And when I got that, there's this really strange kind of push and pull in your mind between, it's hard for you to wrap your head around this being, having at one point been the present.
Yeah.
And I don't know how this book did it, but it managed to kind of evoke that in me, especially during that monologue that he has about that. This feeling that, the present being a whole bunch of pasts that are kind of jostling for attention. So
right. And as we're sort of coming up on the end of the century and the doomsayers are saying things like the human race only has about 1,000 years left on this planet at this pace. Like that's kind of it, sorry to say. Mm-hmm. I don't know, just this, the sense of what, this, how did we get here? How, and where are these things going? And is anybody going to care? And we cared very much, but yeah, who knows?
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, here it comes.
Getting into spoiler territory.
Yeah.
So, when you first started off the book, did you plan for these characters to be the same character? Or did that
No, that just sort of emerged because it's the truism of, when you have two characters, if they're both doing the same thing, then you don't need two characters. It's the dude wears my car problem. You didn't need both of those guys. So
I like that name for it, the dude wears my car problem. Yeah.
So, but as I kept going through it and realizing that the brother really didn't have his own impetus in life. He didn't have wants and needs that were separate from the sister. And so that's what made me start to realize that they were one personality. And there are little clues threaded in before it that this is how she copes with what's happened to her before, in the making the little dollhouse and killing the people in the dollhouse, that it's so much easier to deal with life when you're putting it on an avatar. And that's sort of the thing for me, in that, as a writer, it's easier for me to deal with life when I'm putting it on a character. So that's sort of the two levels of, what's going on. Like I said, this is an intensely autobiographical book. And in the novel, in her desperation, she takes a seminar where she makes an effigy and she writes everything bad that ever happened to her and throws it in the fire and it sets her free. And that's exactly what I did. I wrote a book and I put everything bad on her. And then on the end, I burned her up so I could be free.
Oh, I didn't even get that. That part was so fucking visceral, which visceral leads us to, where the fuck did that ending come from, man? Like that has got to be probably one of, it's not even, you know how we were talking about how David Foster Wallace can just do little things, you know?
Right.
I think the tea kettle analogy was brutal, and there's so much not just in this book but throughout your body of work that I've mm-hmm. read, which I think I've read all of it, about pregnancy, right?
Yeah.
And particularly miscarriages. And mm-hmm. so that was such an interesting choice at the end to have this kind of almost avatar character induce a miscarriage in some like with fire. So that's very rich in symbolism. If you'd like to talk about that,
Well, and, you know, if you may not have guessed, like, I grew up Catholic, so like the idea of, you know, the anima sola and these kind of, you know, and not just Catholic but Italian Catholic, like this very folk Catholicism with all these, you know, unsanctified deities and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So my story, I don't know if you knew about my story with childbirth and everything, but my older son, I was in labor for 90 hours with him.
90
because I was seeing a midwife because I wanted to have a home birth for my own stupid complex psychological reasons that really had more to do with like besting my mother unconsciously, but you know, that's my own hubris and foolishness. So but I had this home birth midwife who really did not know what she was doing and kept me in labor for 3.5 days until I said I want to go to the hospital. I ended up having an emergency C-section and I got PTSD because
of it. I hope you left her a very, very stern Yelp review.
Yeah. Well, but seriously, like, no joke, I went and looked her up recently to see, can I sue her? Unfortunately, the statute of limitations is done, but she's since been barred from practicing medicine because some infants died in her care.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's hard. I got fucking lucky. You know, it's like, what do they say in AA? Like, if life was fair, you'd be dead by now, pretty much.
Wow.
You know?
Jesus, man. Wow.
So, and my son would be dead, but we're both, thank God, we're both okay. And, I got PTSD. I got, I couldn't go into the maternity section of stores without having a breakdown. I couldn't hear about other people's birth. I couldn't attend baby showers. I couldn't see childbirth scenes in the movies. And my personality permanently changed. I became mm-hmm. angrier, snappish. I think that was a large part of what the breakdown of my marriage was. Although, you know, of course I was also married to a jerk, but that's another story. I mean, it certainly didn't help that I had had all of these changes that are consistent with PTSD.
Of course,
and then, so that experience very much that broke me and reshaped me mm-hmm. as an artist. So like Joseph Beuys was a performance artist in the 70s, and he was a fighter pilot during World War II, and he crashed down somewhere in like the, you know, the Ural Mountains, and he was found by some peasants on fire and broken, and they took care of him. They wrapped him in fat and felt, which is all they had, and rabbit skins, and they sort of bundled him up in this and took him back to a yurt and nursed him back to health over 2 days, over 2 weeks, as he's like hallucinating and suffering from head injuries and everything. And the rest of his work used those materials of felt and fat and rabbit skins, you know, everything was so that experience of being in childbirth for 90 hours, that nothing I've been able to become as a writer has not resulted from me being broken and then being put back together from that experience. So I am
like
Genghis.
It's almost like your kid and you were born at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. It was very much like a phoenix kind of experience where you just immolate mm-hmm. and then become something new that has walked through a crucible of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I Am Genghis Khan is all about that. It's all about childbirth. It's all about trying to game the system, the human reproductive system, and losing and failing every time. And you know, the body having the last laugh. And so these questions and these metaphors are things that I just keep coming back to. And, you know, to be on fire in a dog cage is about the approximation of the terror I felt, you know, over 90 hours, except that, you know, I'm the dog cage and my baby that's inside me is the thing that's, you know, like I'm killing it. I'm the one that's keeping it. So there's just no words for, you know, like what David Cronenberg talked about, that the ultimate horror is the revolt of the body against
mm-hmm.
yourself
mm-hmm.
and of realizing, you know, people, some women, when they're pregnant, they talk about, oh, it's so magical, you know, because you really see what you're made for. You really see what your body is made for. And I just more saw it as like, I see my body's capacity to really just, you know, have a blank reptilian disregard for me as a human being, wow, for me as a soul or a spirit, that it was going to do this. And if I died, it really, you know, to see one's own body with the same heartlessness as like a shark is a really shattering experience. So, and I don't intentionally put these things in the book, but going back to it, I can see all these places, like when she says, you know, and I was not numb, but calm, like the bomb in the belly of the Enola Gay. Like I keep coming back to these pregnancy metaphors and these childbirth metaphors. And, but of course, to destroy a baby is to destroy your future. And that's a lot of what the book is about, you know, privileging the past over the future and letting go of just that kind of that intersection of forgiving and forgetting and remembering and moving forward and not moving forward. And, you know, baby in some ways is the ultimate expression of that. And,
I had a really similar, realization recently in my life that I'd never had before, cause I'd never really understood body horror. But then, just people started dropping like flies in my, near vicinity, and just watching that kind of deterioration, it was like, holy shit, that really is scary. Like, we don't have this is literally a car that we're in that's made out of like blood and bone and shit, and it doesn't really function based on what's going on in our conscious mind. But I guess the interesting thing to me is that this immolation takes place in the form of a revenge. Symbolically, I'm kind of interested in that, because in a way it's your avatar that is creating this. I understand that characters obviously aren't 100% representative of the person who are writing them, so in that case, is there kind of a Lynchian switch going on where you're no longer that character?
Well, I mean, I think the other thing to remember is that a lot of this is coming out in the aftermath of a very, very painful divorce. And there's really just no words for divorce, even if you go into it with like a feeling of, hey, you know, we're cool and we're modern and it's just a piece of paper. Like, once you are divorced, that just hits you like a just whammied. And if you know someone who's gotten divorced, just be prepared for the next 3 to 5 years. They're not going to have their head on straight. They're just going to be hurting and bewildered in a way that is almost teenage, you know. So I mean, that I think a lot of that scene is, you know, anger at my ex-husband about feeling like you get to go forward into a future and I don't, because I'm stuck here being poor and in a city I didn't want to be in. And, you know, like, you got your professor job and I'm, and that the thing is that, like, she has a moment, the sister has a moment where she can choose redemption. And I put that in there purposely, because there needs to be a branching from, you know, if I'm writing this to burn her up and get all of this off of my chest, then there needs to be a branching where I chose one path and she chose the other, you know. And there is a point where she says, I realize that I am not bad. I am good yet hurt. That is not the same. Mm-hmm. And she has a moment where she says, you know what, I could just let it all go. And she chooses not to. And the fact that she chooses not to, she pays for it, you know. And so.
Well, that concludes my questions about the book, but I do have questions about film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I know that you were how long did you say that you were a film critic for?
Let's see, I've been doing it since about 2004. My first review was for Shrek 2, and I took about like 30 pages worth of notes for it because I was so excited, and I didn't know, you know, how much you need to write a review. So,
how long did the review end up being?
I think it was 800 words.
And you're like, I don't know, it's kind of funny.
Right. I was very prepared.
Right. So, have you seen anything recently that really kind of just got under your skin or you particularly enjoyed?
Yeah, totally. So one that's in theaters now is called The Love Witch, and it's by this director, I think her name is Anna Biller, and she, you want to talk about auteur stamp, like this woman, like I was reading an interview with her, and they said, well, how come it took you 7 years to make this movie? And she said, well, I didn't have a budget, so I had to sew all the costumes myself.
Fuck.
I was like, what? And she also did the set design, and she edited it and wrote and directed and everything. It's a movie that's in the style of a 70s erotic occult melodrama, like a Radley Metzger, Mario Bava kind of thing. It is spot on. When I saw the trailer, I thought it was a restored drive-in movie that they'd found somewhere rather than a new piece of work. And there's not a moment where like an anachronism creaks in, except like, you know, one character has a cell phone, but it's not anachronism. It's just sort of like a rule for this weird world. And it's about this woman who she wants to find a lover and she wants to use witchcraft to get it. And it was just amazing. I just admired her, just her gumption for like putting together this crazy thing and just not seeing any of the seams in it, just doing such a total job about it. The other thing that I've seen that I really liked this year, and it's not coming out until Christmas Day, is called 20th Century Women. And it's a sequel of sorts with this director. I can't remember his name, but the first movie he did was called Beginners, which was sort of autobiographical. It was about a guy whose 75-year-old father like picks now to come out of the closet and decides he wants to tell everybody that he's gay. And so this movie is sort of the sequel. It's based on his life with his mother. And she's played by Annette Bening. She runs a boarding house in 1979 Santa Barbara. And it's just sort of the eclectic people that come in. There's a young photographer played by Greta Gerwig, who's just my favorite actress. I just adore her and just have such a crush on her. So I love everything she does. And there's Elle Fanning is the girl next door who creeps into her son's bedroom every night to talk about her, you know, her miserable sexual conquest with other men, but she won't have sex with the son because like they're best friends and she doesn't want to ruin that. And the guy is like, oh my God, please.
Right, so, there's
like a, you know, this amiable handyman who lives there. It's just kind of, it's got a very kind of like pregnant waiting, you know, last gasp of the 70s. Everything is going to change very soon with Reagan kind of, you know, summer's end sort of feel to it. And it's a lot about the music too, like Talking Heads and Devo. And it's just really just so sure, so confident. So I'm really I think that and Deadpool are the two movies I saw this year that I liked the most. And I'm trying to usually like when I have two movies, I can usually find a common theme between them about why I like them. This one has me a little stumped. So I'm going to have to think a little more about that.
I did like Deadpool a lot. That one was fun. It was a fun movie, man. It was just good, you know?
Yeah. It had no ponderous to it. It just wanted to be just freewheeling and anarchic, and I gotta admire that.
Oh yeah, I like that. And I can't stand comic book movies at all.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a grump. I realize that. Like, I don't like video games and I don't like comic book movies. Some comic books are okay, but I don't know what it is. They just don't keep my attention.
Right.
I think it goes back to kind of what I was writing about. And I like film and books and even video games that are very aggressive and that agitate and push buttons and stuff. And I think Deadpool did that. I think it even did it with, you know, his kind of meta fourth wall breaking shit, you know. So it's kind of like right there in my wheelhouse. But I think probably the best one I saw this year was either The Handmaiden or The Invitation, which I thought
now,
was...
Which I don't think I saw either of those, so what were they?
Okay, so The Handmaiden is the new Park Chan-wook film, and it is about... It's kind of starts off as a crime film, so it's based in the early 20th century Korea, and this con man basically is pretending to be... this wealthy duke or whatever, and he's going to seduce a woman who is a widow and has a shit ton of money, basically. Mm-hmm. And he brings along a sort of criminal companion of his, this young woman, and her job is to butter the woman up so that she can be seduced by this guy, you know? Mm-hmm. And it ends up being that the women fall in love. And start to have a relationship. Mm-hmm. And then the film is divided very clearly into three acts. So that's kind of the first act is this woman deciding if she's actually going to go through with this betrayal, because the idea is that after the guy marries this woman, he's going to put her in a mental hospital and keep all of her money and stuff like that. But and so it just gets increasingly twisty and surreal and gross in a way that I think Park Chan-wook is really, really good at.
Now he did Old Boy, right?
That's correct. Yeah, Old Boy, and Lady Vengeance and Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. And the other one, The Invitation, I think is actually on Netflix, and it's a Karen Kusama film.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
So she did Girl Fight and Aeon Flux, which was like so crazy that she's done such great films. And then, you know, once she finally got a huge budget, it was a total disaster. But so Invitation is back to being sort of indie. And basically this guy is invited by his ex-wife to a dinner party with her new boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And all of their old friends are there. And as the film goes on, the tension kind of rises and rises as the guy sort of begins to suspect that his wife and this guy are now part of a creepy death cult. And so it's this very paranoid film where you're not really sure. They do a fantastic job of like, the couple does some really creepy shit, but it's always just this side of, you know, this is very, very strange, you know? So,
right.
And it just builds and builds. Of course, the tension builds and builds. It's really, really fantastic. But, yeah, I think those are probably the two best. And then I liked Green Room a lot too.
Mm-hmm,
that was
mm-hmm.
a lot of fun. Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah, so that's mine.
That's cool. I mean, I got to go back through and think about, because I did catch a lot of things on Netflix this year because I was up nursing my infant son. So that's where I saw Los Angeles Plays Itself, which I think, when I think about it, that'll also be a favorite for this year. And then I think that Errol Morris movie Tabloid, that's not this year. That's older there. That's just an all-time favorite. Have you ever seen that one?
I have never seen an Errol Morris movie, I don't think.
This one is definitely one to start with. So it's an extended interview with Joyce McKinney, who is this, you know, chipper blonde Southern belle. She's probably in her 50s. And she's going to tell you the story of the greatest love affair of her life that just set her whole life. But it turned out what that was she fell obsessive head over heels in love with this young Mormon when they were both 18. And then he left to go do his Mormon missionary work in England. She was convinced that the Mormons stole him. So she went to England with two other guys to go kidnap him and bring him back for love. And like took him, like chloroformed him and took him to a deserted cottage where she says, "Oh, we had the most wonderful romantic. It was like a honeymoon." And he says that she chained him to the bed and like forcibly tried to get him to impregnate her. And
this sounds like a fucking Coen Brothers movie.
It does. And the story just gets stranger and stranger as you start to realize, like, oh, how did she get the money to finance all this? I won't give it away, but it's one of those, where the hell do you find these people, Errol Morris? But that,
that's. Yeah, I watched that Into the Inferno, the new Werner Herzog documentary, and that was really good too. It's very meandering, because he just kind of he picks active volcanoes across the globe and then documents the surrounding culture. And I think the most interesting part, he goes to Mount Biktu in North Korea, and so there's anything about North Korea I find completely fascinating. And I think the biggest question that I have is that I wonder, obviously their lives are completely different than ours in a lot of superficial ways, but inside their heads, as like that kind of qualitative experience, do all of them really understand that they're living under this, you know, incredibly iron-willed, you know, dictatorship? Or since they grew up with it, are they just like, oh, this is just life, this is whatever.
Right. Well, I mean, I think about that too. I asked my son, how was school today? And did you do anything fun? He said, we had a lockdown, because there was, you know, somebody in the building. I was like, crap, I got to find out what this was about. Mm-hmm. And you want to talk about, like, you know, living at the lip of a volcano. I mean, here in Philadelphia, like 4 weeks. So what, there's been like over 1,000 public gun massacres since Sandy Hook in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 4 weeks ago, it was our turn in this neighborhood. Like, I was coming home at 11:30 and I was like, gee, it's funny. There's three police helicopters in the sky. I never see that. And then, like an idiot, I'm like, oh, I wonder if I go down to the corner if I can see what's going on. So I'm like sort of craning down. I'm like, nah, it must be, you know, 2 or 3 blocks up. I can't see it. And this was the day that some 25-year-old dude with a gun just said, that's it. Life sucks. You know, he's part of the 2 a.m. club. And he's like, this is the day. I'm going to shoot a cop. I'm going to shoot somebody, you know, at a bar. I'm going to shoot somebody driving by in a car. I'm going to kill them. And then I'm going to go run out to the car dealership and wait for the police to just shoot me. And it's like, you know, you want to talk about living under the lip of a volcano and just kind of getting used to it. And it's like, yeah, it's the same situation. I remember when I was in Naples, I went up to Vesuvius and they all assured me, well, first of all, Naples doesn't have any evacuation plan for Vesuvius at all because it upsets them too much to think about it. But in the church, they have a vial of saint's blood. And every year if they shake it, if it liquefies again, then they're safe.
Oh, good.
And it's only been wrong once. So that's good. So they're not worried, you know? So we went up to the top of Vesuvius. Of course, I'm like an anxious wreck going up here. But it's just kind of this big, you know, this gigantic crater with, it looks like gravel in it, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a souvenir stand at the lip of Mount Vesuvius. And I'm like, what does he do? He, like, you know, gets off work and goes to the bar with all these, like, firefighters and EMTs and prison guards. And they all treat him with tremendous respect because he's got to go work at a souvenir shack on the lip of an active volcano.
So. Yeah, that's fucking wild. Yeah, you're totally fucked if that goes off.
Right, like, exactly. Yeah. You're done. Yeah, so.
Well, yeah, hopefully he gets good insurance or whatever. But yeah, I think right. that's, I didn't even think about the gun violence thing, but the way that's normalized, because even as you're talking about it, it doesn't register to me as a horrifying of a thing as it really does. Which,
right.
You know, it could just be, you know, I might have a little bit of a lack of empathy or something. I might be a robot. Who knows?
Yeah, right, right.
But yeah, no, you're talking about it and it's registering, but I'm like, but yeah, that's just kind of what happens here.
Yeah. If I was explaining that to somebody from another country that my son said, oh, it was a lockdown at school, and I didn't say, what? And, you know, knock over everything on the table.
Yeah.
It's I just rolled my eyes and says, oh, God.
Another
you know.
Lockdown. Here we go.
Yeah, exactly.